I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Amanda Sussman was a policy advisor on human rights and refugee issues to Bill Graham when he was Minister of Foreign Affairs and Eleanor Kaplan when she was Minister of Citizenship and Immigration. She has had extensive work with organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. She's written a new book, her first, The Art of the Possible, a handbook for political activism. It is an instructive and useful book that opens the doors of government to show how we can make a difference. She joins me now to talk about how government works and how we can have an impact. Currently, she is policy advisor to Plan Canada. The Art of the Possible is published by McClelland & Stewart and retails for $22.99. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Amanda Sussman. Good morning, Ms. Sussman.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Why did you write this book and for whom?
Well, one of the things that frustrated me most in government was seeing well-intended groups of citizens fundraise, scrape together the money, send someone to Ottawa, only to direct their message to the wrong department 2 weeks after the decision was made, or simply try to push an issue that had very little chance of moving at a given time. I really felt that coming from an advocacy background, I know how that can kill the motivation of citizens to continue being active, but it's equally frustrating for officials who don't always want to have to say no. So the goal of the Art of the Possible is to make the interactions between citizens groups and officials more effective so that they can have a greater impact on government policy.
You come from a unique position having worked in government, and then before that, as you write in the book, you had some involvement with Greenpeace. You'd lived out here in Vancouver, in Kitts actually, right?
That's right, yeah.
And what was your involvement with Greenpeace?
Well, at that stage, I was in university, so I was a student, and I was really just canvassing door-to-door and volunteering on the Clayo Cut Sound campaign, which I think, you know, globally Greenpeace is very effective. But at that stage in my life, I was frustrated because I personally wasn't seeing any results, and I realized that I really didn't understand how decisions got made and how I could be effective in choosing to volunteer my time so that I can actually see progress.
And you said you were frustrated about not seeing any results.
Yeah.
What did you do then? Did you leave Greenpeace? Did you do some of the things that you write about in the book?
Well, actually, I went back to school and I did international affairs and economics in Washington, D.C. And then I worked for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. So I spent some more time with different advocacy organizations from a different perspective, and then I also learned how policy decisions get made through school and then going into government. So I really tried to have both perspectives so that I could see where the channels were for opportunity.
And the experience with Greenpeace in fundraising, canvassing, and so on, from what you say, there was a lack of coordination, that they weren't as effective as they possibly could. Was that largely the experience that Greenpeace has? Is that, you see that with most groups, do you think, nowadays? Or what is that? Why is that?
Well, you know, in the book I draw a distinction between, there's sort of two approaches you can take to advocacy. You can take a radical approach where you push for everything, and there's no negotiation, no compromise. You do protests, you do boycotts, public awareness issues, and then there's a reformist approach where you work inside the system, so you're working with officials and you're on the details of government policy, and I argue that you need both, and Greenpeace is actually an organization that can be very effective at both, especially on the first part, the raising awareness, because politicians don't create the bandwagon, they jump on it, so all that fundraising work and canvassing work and public awareness campaigns provide the constituency for the government to respond to and to resist pressure from officials and other sectors to take policies sort of further than they may even want to. But what I argue is that right now there's too many radicals and far too few reformers. So a lot of people would rather go to a protest at the G8 meeting or whatnot rather than get into the details of government policy and start to look at really participating in decision-making. And that's where I found it was extremely imbalanced in government. And there was a real need for more citizens groups to be in there at the central tables so that ministers have full information before they make a decision.
You know, some of those the those radicals that you talk about, the anti-globalization protesters, for example, who protest at G8 summits and the WTO and so on,
yeah.
they will say that they have had an impact. But you say that there are too many of them.
Well, what I'm saying is that they have had an impact, and on the public, and as I say, on the public awareness side, they pointed out that there is a problem and it needs to be solved. But I think many of those same activists are really frustrated right now that while they've had a public success, they've had very little policy success. Where's the actual change in policy? Where's the response to their concerns? And one of the things I write about is I was on the inside of the Kananaskis meeting, and you saw it again this summer. Stephen Harper called the protest sad, which is incredibly frustrating. But the reason being, from the inside of those meetings, that the protest approach backfired because the politicians were left with the impression that these are just fringe elements of society, it's a very narrow group, and they want the impossible. You know, no globalization, no free trade, dismantle the World Bank and the IMF. So I think that's why I say there's too much focus. I mean, you still need that public awareness push, but we need to actually see results. You need to get involved much earlier than the date of the G8 itself. And it requires working in the system and identifying internal advocates, building your case, knowing who your opponents are. And that's what this book is geared to do, to help average people understand how it works. So if they're only going to do one intervention or one event or one meeting, it can be the most effective meeting there is.
So one thing that I find really interesting that you write about in the book, and people should pick it up for it because it is instructive, as I said, was you talk about, I'll ask you, do you, after you finished grad school, you worked with these human rights organizations that I listed up top, did you go into government soon after that?
Actually, my route into government was a little bit odd. I actually went to work in a refugee camp for the United Nations in Mexico with Guatemalan refugees who were living there. And I happened to be home visiting my family when I met the chief of staff to the newly appointed Minister of Immigration. And what was interesting is she had identified that very same problem. The advice that she was getting from her officials was very much security focused. And, you know, the government views that the only responsible approach is to take this better safe than sorry approach. So she was getting a lot of security advice, but not a lot of balance on the other side. Well, what would that look like from the perspective of a genuine refugee or a genuine immigrant? So the chief of staff asked me to come directly into the minister's office and provide that other alternative voice.
And that was, you worked closely with Eleanor Kaplan, did you?
I did, yes. I was on her personal staff.
One of the things you talk about when you were, I guess the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act that was passed in 2002,
yes.
Was that under her watch?
That was.
And there is a story in the book you talk about how that legislation came about.
Yes.
Would you tell us that story? Because I think it is instructive about the machinery of government.
Absolutely. Well, and this is actually one of the motivations for the book. As I say, one of the key issues then was the officials were starting to push this idea of introducing detention based on suspicion alone. And of course, you know, from a human rights perspective, this is unthinkable. A fundamental principle of our system is innocent until proven guilty. But here's how it comes about. The officials start to look at, present facts to a politician that say, listen, none of the would-be terrorists had criminal records prior to their activities. And this is generally the case with these loose terrorist networks today. So the case before you is, would you rather underestimate a terrorist threat and live with the consequences of a shocking headline of a shoe bomber that slips through the system? Or are we going to introduce some measures and you'll have to suffer the consequences of a grumbling civil liberties community? So really, once an issue is presented like that, it's like a knife to the throat of the decision maker. They really have no choice but to take a better safe than sorry approach. And that's where I found that there was a real, real need for credible advocacy groups to be in there on those discussions with tackling those extreme cases that where the starting point for the discussions are now, to say, well, where can we draw the line and where should the safeguards be? Because without that active presence, they're going to cast the net very, very wide. And that's my assessment now of what happened with the new Immigration Act.
And then you worked with Bill Graham
yes.
soon after that he was Minister of Foreign Affairs, correct?
That's right.
Working in the government informed you about the process, certainly, and it showed you what advocacy groups that you were once a part, like Greenpeace, what they ought to do, and how important it is to know the machinery of government.
Yes.
Is it, I mean, this book obviously gives you that overview and you know, the minutiae and the details of how bills are passed or how the difference between legislation and, I guess, regulation, correct?
That's right.
And so this knowledge gap that advocacy groups have, why do you think they have this, why do you think they've been unknowledgeable towards the machinery of government heretofore?
Well, you know, of course there are groups that are very sophisticated in their knowledge. Alex Neve, Amnesty International is one. But, I mean, really it's an issue of resources. You know, certain sectors can afford to hire expensive government relations firms, and they know, you know, how to present the right brief at every level of decision-making at the right time. But it's really a resource issue. Citizens groups just don't have the time or the money to be able to get that kind of knowledge, which was another motivation for writing the book, because it's not rocket science. In fact, to create the book, I interviewed about dozens of ministers, MPs, officials, to make sure that the advice I'm giving is a collective advice. But what happened pretty quickly is my interviews were redundant. Everybody in government says the same thing. So my goal was to provide something easily accessible to the public, to put them on par with those sectors that have more resources to know how it works.
Did working in the government, did that perhaps make you cynical about the process? One would think it would.
Well, you know, it actually didn't, because I saw enormous opportunities that weren't being exercised. So I talk about how, especially in Canada, it's remarkably accessible. We still have a functioning democracy, and you have very easy access to politicians as well as to officials, just sheer numbers. I mean, if you get involved in any cause, you'll quickly find that within the scope of a few months, you know who the main players are, you know who the main officials are, who the other groups are, who your opponents are. So it's actually there's a lot of channels to work, and that are being underutilized, which is why I really encourage more people to take that reformist route. And it doesn't mean compromising on your values. I mean, successful groups can work both ways at once, as long as you're open about what you're doing and you're not undermining the work you're doing internally. But I do remain optimistic that there's a lot, and you'll see progress pretty quickly. And it's not going to be, and when I say progress, it's not going to be that your recommendation is going to be adopted exactly as you proposed it. But if you make the arguments well at the right time and you take into account government constraints, you will see your issues start to take steps forward.
This is not a book simply for organizations, but individuals as well, correct?
That's right. Yeah, my first chapter is on where do I start.
And do you find that individuals who write letters to their MPs or write letters to the minister on a certain issue, that they get read, that their feedback is considered?
Yeah. I talk about writing letters. I talk about how the first step to take, because I think that's the most obvious one. And letters are only as effective as the objective of the letter and the timing. And one of the things I talk about is directing your interventions towards the people who actually have power or influence over that issue. So for some issues it may be an MP, but for some issues it may be an official or a minister. So what I try to do is tell people easy ways that they can get involved, but the first one involves finding others and organizing with a group that's right for you, so that you're not, because if you do just sort of take the obvious path, it maybe might not be the most strategic one, and then that's where you feel like you're banging your head against the wall. So writing a letter to an MP may be the most effective choice, but it depends on your issue and the time, and I talk about that in the book.
Something that I found interesting in the book, and I think you talked to a number of senators who said that involving senators and you know, the staff of the Senate is important when you're proposing things. And I don't think people think much about that, do they?
They actually don't, no. And the senators I interviewed said, especially as you're working with MPs, work it with senators simultaneously. And senators can play a major role, not necessarily in policy again, but in public awareness. But also, by the time the bill hits the Senate, you want them to be well briefed on what the issues are, where the problems are, where the opponents are. And when senators choose to champion an issue, they can have quite an impact.
When you're in working with a minister and a decision needs to be taken, the two ministers that you work closely with, do you find that they, I'm not talking specifically about Minister Graham or Kaplan, but in the whole scheme of government, whether it's a Liberal government or Conservative government, when a minister seeks information on a subject, and I gather they want all sides of the issue to help inform their decision,
yes.
the bureaucrats who are there and advisors like you, you obviously bring everything together for the minister to make their decision.
Do you
find that all sides are covered, and do you also find that ministers are that they listen to all sides, that they take into consideration every single detail, not every single detail, but I mean a great overview of the issue that they're to take a decision on?
That's exactly my point. I think the answer is not always. I mean, the reality is that it's really a timing issue. The volume of work that's going through a minister's desk is absolutely enormous. I mean, they have their role as MPs in the House, following everything that's all the legislation, the role in cabinet, where they intervene or comment on all the other decisions of other departments, the role of as head of the department, and their constituency matters. So one of my points is that, you know, 99% of the decisions that are going through are really driven by the officials, and it is all in how you present those options for decision, because the minister doesn't have time at that last moment to unravel the issue and dissect it, and unless it's one that he or she has chosen as a priority. So that's what I argue, is that you have to work both top-down and bottom-up, so that all the way through you're aware of how the minister is going to be briefed. And if you're not getting anywhere with the bureaucrats and you feel like that one perspective is not being reflected, which I saw often on in some cases, then working with the political staff or with the minister themselves, and then you're really giving them the right questions to ask. So what can the minister do? They can say, you know what, I'm not making a decision, go back, give me two more options that take this into consideration. And that's a reasonable request of a minister, and they welcome that. So it is a matter of, and that's the goal of this, is to round out the options that are presented and to make sure the minister has fuller information.
Has the 2006 Accountability Act, has that affected how citizens go to government, how they interact with ministers and officials? You write about that in your book.
Well, we're still waiting to hear what the regulations are going to say, but a lot of us are very concerned about that act because, well, for one, it uses this term lobbying, and I'm really concerned about just even this. I draw a distinction between advocacy and lobbying. Lobbying paints this broad negative brush across a whole range of activities that are and always have been necessary and legitimate for the proper functioning of government. But, you know, to lobby is to sell, to persuade, to pull strings, to hype. With advocacy, the emphasis is on the notion of support. To advocate is to argue for, to back up, to defend, to encourage, to justify. And advocating is both honorable and legal. And my concern is that, one, it discourages the Accountability Act, as written, discourages officials from those inevitable direct interactions that have always taken place, but also discourages people on the outside from wanting to label themselves as lobbyists. And all of these concerns have been raised, and this is why the regulations are stalled. And so I think it will be interesting to see what comes down, but the government knows it can't go as far as its intended message was. So we're all waiting to see what the regulations will say.
Yeah, and finally, Amanda, you work with Plan Canada. What's the nature of your work there?
Right now I'm a policy advisor to Plan Canada. So actually, Plan is interesting. It's an international organization, and it hasn't really so far played much of a policy role in Canada. And although it has so much resource and expertise from over 70 years in the field, it hasn't really participated in some of the central discussions. So I'm helping them choose what the priorities are and to take a more active role internally in the international development issues in particular.
I want to congratulate you on this book. It's been a fascinating and interesting book. Did you enjoy writing it?
You know, I actually did, and mainly why is the feedback I'm getting. I get emails from people working in groups saying, wow, thank you, you know, that meeting came through, it was a good meeting, there's going to be follow-up, and I can just see that it is very empowering for people to feel like they have a way to feel that their efforts are useful. So it's very rewarding.
And did you plan on writing another book?
Not in the near future. We'll see. I'd rather go back to working on the issues for a while.
Amanda, thanks so much for joining us today. Congratulations on the book again, and continued good luck with it.
Thank you very much.
The book is called The Art of the Possible, A Handbook for Political Activism, $22.99 from McClelland & Stewart. I'm Joseph Planta.